Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Gene Ellert, ministering to survivors of domestic sex trafficking.
So we specialize in specifically sex trafficking. One, because it's significant in this country, but two, we also attend very specifically to the wounding that comes with being sexually violated. And the majority of the women, the vast majority of women and girls that we have seen, 96%, were molested as children and have known abuse and neglect and violence since a young age, even before they were commercialized.
Gene Ellert, next. The Baltimore, Maryland-based Samaritan Women not only brings hope and healing to women and girls who are victims of sex trafficking, but they're a resource to help people in other states begin similar ministries. Gene Ellert is the founder and executive director of Samaritan Women. Gene, you founded this ministry a number of years ago. How did you sense God calling you into it?
Well, the shortest answer is through a broken heart. I was not looking to get into ministry at all. I was rather enjoying my life of affluence and self-indulgence, quite frankly, when I was living in the Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah.
And, you know, God had me on a journey that took a bit of a while. I really came to Christ in 2004. Was always sort of raised, a creaster up till then, And Christmas and Easter, kind of, not much depth, And then it really just started to have my own spiritual awakening happening in my early 40s. And that led me to go to seminary and get a degree, in church ministries. And about that same time, I was invited to go with a group that was doing a street outreach in Baltimore to women in prostitution. And truly, I went on a lark. I wasn't really very serious about that. I just wanted to, honor my commitment that I said that I would go. Little did I know that God had an appointment waiting for me. And that appointment was largely with one particular woman who opened my eyes, broke my heart. Her name is Heather. We're still in contact today, 15 years later. And she showed me a world that honestly, I think most of us, it's hidden in plain sight for us. The people we sort of turn our gaze and don't look at, or neighborhoods we don't go into. And hearing her story and just realizing that, there by the grace of God go so many, and why her? And why did that happen for her when she was just a tender little 14-year-old child? And so all these why questions that started to create this unrest in me. And the more I started trying to research my questions, the more I kept coming up with dead ends. And I tell college students now, be very careful when you sort of shake your fist at God and say, why aren't you doing something?
Yes.
Because sometimes he's meaning for you to do it. And that's kind of a short version of how I did a 180 in my life and ended up, as they say, sell everything and give it to the poor, buying the property that we have in Baltimore, starting the organization, and then committing, the last 14, 15 years of my life to these amazing women.
And now the subject, of course, is human trafficking, sex trafficking. These terms have become sort of, overused. Possibly people are aware of them. They think, I know what that is. But you've worked in this area helping women and girls recover from this as victims. How would you define that? What is it and the scope of the problem in the U.S.? Can you give us a bit of a sense of what's going on?
Yeah, and to your point, you know, language really matters. And I think one of the things we have to understand is that the idea of human trafficking, it's not putting a new label on, as they dare to say, the oldest oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Human trafficking is a specific type of crime that involves compelling individuals into servitude, labor, sex trafficking. So there's lots of different manifestations of human trafficking. You could have the kids in the city that are begging on the, you know, intersections. You could have child brides and child soldiers and mail order brides and domestic servants. And so there are many, many forms of human trafficking globally. And we have certain expressions of that here in the United States. The one that gets the largest attention, because it's a significant crime here in the U.S., is selling people for sexual commercialization. And so think of it as sex trafficking is a subset of human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other large subset is all the different forms of labor trafficking. So we specialize in specifically sex trafficking, one, because it's significant in this country, but two, we also attend very specifically to the wounding that comes with being sexually violated. And the majority of the women, the vast majority of women and girls that we have seen, 96%, were molested as children and have known abuse and neglect and violence since a young age, even before they were commercialized.
And numbers, Jean, obviously the government, some entity, must keep track. I mean, I realize these are probably estimates, adults, children, and I think I saw something where you said anyone under 18 is immediately, automatically considered a victim. But what can you tell us about the numbers of people that are trafficked in this way?
Yeah, specifically, I can tell you very little because we're learning. And, you know, the United States only sort of started officially recognizing this in 2010. So we've only been at this a decade. Actually, in 2010 is when it was in the Trafficking in Persons Report was recorded through the State Department. That was one landmark moment. The law actually goes back to 2000, and then it's been amended. All of that is to say we are still very much in a process of learning and understanding. And I have to tell you, it's difficult, too, because new manifestations of this crime keep appearing. So there's a bit of a whack-a-mole that is a part of this field. But let me tell you what we have so far.
Okay.
The last few years, there's been a statistic anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000 victims of trafficking across the United States. And those numbers get refuted often. But now what we're starting to see is reports that are bubbling up at the state level. And I think those are helpful because sometimes at the state level, we can get a better handle on our own data. You know, when we talk about crimes, we have to understand that jurisdictions largely are responsible for collecting their data. And from one jurisdiction to another, you may not have the same data collection priorities or strategies. So what we might focus on in Maryland might not be the same as in Virginia. And so even though we're conjoined, right,
yeah,
we may not be able to get to the same numbers. So all of those caveats aside, so here's what we have seen. For example, Texas, University of Texas at Austin, put out a report about a year ago, year and a half ago now, saying that they estimate over 280,000 victims of labor trafficking in their state and 79,000 child victims of trafficking, sex trafficking. So that's just within the state of Texas.
Hmm.
Kentucky put out a report a year ago. It was actually released in 19, and they looked at over 628 cases of child sex trafficking in their state, and then examined those cases. to try to better understand what was the nature of that exploitation, what percentage of them was trafficking from out of the family. We call it familial trafficking versus commercial trafficking or by a stranger, a pimp trafficker.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing studies that are starting to bubble up. Ohio's done some good work in this area, Florida, Georgia. But across the United States, we don't have definitive numbers.
Well, my guest today on His People is Jean Ellert, and we're talking about human trafficking and particularly the work that she does with the Samaritan Women, a ministry that she started back in 2007 to victims of human, particularly sex trafficking. Jean, where do you get the name, or where does the name the Samaritan Women come from? Why did you call the organization that?
Well, it's reference to John 4, when Jesus encountered the woman at the well. And the reason that we wanted to build our identity around that verse of Scripture was we wanted to embody the non-judgmental stance that Christ took with that woman, in spite of, as it says, all that she had ever done. And that was so important to us that we wanted to be able to say, could we create that place where a woman could have an encounter with the Lord Jesus and be eternally transformed by that? And so that verse became our namesake. But I'll tell you, there's been a postscript since we chose that back in 07. After I had been in this work about 3 years, I'll tell you, I was worried about how we were going to raise money and public support and those types of things. And I started just within my own spirit wondering, are we too churchy?
Hmm.
You know, is it maybe, a lot of people would call us and they say, is this the American women, not the Samaritan women?
Oh, yeah.
And so I started to doubt the name, but it's important to know that was just something that was happening in my own head. And I had a group of volunteers out here on the property, a big group of volunteers, and at one point this young student came running back, and she's like, Jean, you got to come see what we found. And we went back into the wooded area, and the volunteers had pulled back all of this brush, and there was a well.
Oh.
And I just knew that I knew that I knew that that was God saying,
yeah,
if I went to the trouble of giving you a well, don't doubt the name.
That's amazing. Well, Jean, before we get too much further, I should ask you, what are your objectives? How do these women, how do these girls come to you? And then what are your objectives? What plans do you have for them?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that in two parts, where we've been for the last 12 years and where we're going forward.
Okay.
So when we first started, we wanted to be a place of healing for this population, and there were very few of us across the United States doing this, and so we largely had to invent our care model, and we were greatly taught by the women themselves. And so for the first 12 years, we focused on providing long-term restorative care. We wanted to see these women re-enter society in a way that would be safe, would not lead them to re-victimization, would give them a sense of agency and contribution in the world, where they could see the fullness of who they were created to be, hopefully with a relationship with Christ and with a relationship with a community, because this is such a disenfranchised population. You know, even today, they are the Hester Primes, the women we don't want to talk about, we don't want to talk to. And so they're so disenfranchised and so alienated. So community is a huge part of what we do, and help not only help them reenter society, but help society accept them. So a fair amount of our work concurrently in caring for the women was also preparing the community to receive this population, whether that's churches being open and welcoming, or whether that's employers being willing to give somebody a second chance, volunteering, and lots of different ways in which we said we've got to work on both sides so that they can re-enter the world and see who God made them to be. So we invested in them academically, vocationally, spiritually, socially, therapeutically. It's the whole person. Because these women would come to us from all over the United States. We had 22 different states that were referring to us. And oftentimes they were leaving their entire life behind. And so for many of them, it was a complete start. I'll tell you a funny little story. You know, sometimes people think of Baltimore and you don't necessarily think of that as, you know, pastoral place of healing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just sort of characterize it as, you know, the TV show The Wire. And the funny thing is that, you know, for somebody for whom their life has been chaos since they were very young, and family is sometimes not safe, you know, definitely not a resource to them. They feel as though they have burned every bridge they've ever had. What I admire about this population is they're just what seems to be their endless well of maybe this time, maybe this time, you know, this group will be different, or they'll be able to help me, or I'll be able to change. So that resiliency and that desire, that wellspring of hope is something that we try to tap into as early as possible. So we help them do job training. We help them with schooling. We, at one point, we had 80% of our women were in college, and all of them were on the dean's list. So we see great things come out of putting people in a different environment, in a different community, of people who believe that you can be who you know, desire to be. And so we've been doing that, like I say, for about 12 years. And then concurrent with that, we were getting a lot of contacts from other shelters or people who wanted to get involved in this work, asking us if they could learn from us, if they could study our model. We had people even overseas who would come to the United States and spend time with us to try to glean so that they could go back into their area and create a replication of this program. And that became for us just a prompting of the spirit to say, is God taking us in a new direction or the next level? And so we went into a time of discernment and realized that God was really calling us to move into more of a multiplication model. Because we could handle in our facility, maybe over the course of a year, maybe 18 women would come through the program to some level. And we had to imagine how much more of an impact could we have if we went and helped to equip others to do this work. So concurrently, we started back in 2016 studying the landscape of care across the United States. And I know you know some of the agencies that have been doing this work, some for a while and some for a short period. So here's what we've learned by studying the landscape. As of, let's say, August of this year, 2020, we've been able to identify 177 shelter programs across the United States that specialize in this kind of care for this population. We have been able to identify out of that how many of them serve women versus boys versus, you know, all genders versus women with children, those that are minors, adults, et cetera. But even out of 177 shelters, that's only about 1,300 beds. So go back to the numbers we talked about, or at least the numbers we think we have. Even if it's just 300,000, we only have 1,300 beds.
And most of these, Jean, my understanding is, are, like yours, Christian or faith-based?
About 70%. Yeah, 65 to 70% of them are Christian-run organizations. And so that's an acute, or that's an important question. One, because we have to read into this. These are not large institutional, well-resourced. These are, in most cases, residential homes in residential communities. So the average shelter that exists has a bed capacity of six, six to eight. So we're talking about an average size home that may be in anywhere USA, and a number of them are just in residential neighborhoods you would never know, and people shouldn't be worried about that. There's not really a threat that we should read into that. There's actually a great beauty in these, in our case, women being able to assimilate into taking the same bus you take, you know?
Yeah.
Going to the same grocery store you go to, and to be able to practice fitting in. It's incredibly beneficial. So, back to where we are going forward, as we began to look at that huge gap and we identified states that have no shelter whatsoever or states that only have one program, largely insufficient to meet the need, and then recognizing that shelters who are available were taking referrals from all over the country. Sometimes that's advantageous because sometimes if she's been exploited, you know, let's say in Michigan, she wants to get out of Michigan.
Mm.
And so sometimes relocation is a good idea. Sometimes it's not beneficial to her because maybe she has kids in that state. But if there are no services available, she has to make that really tough decision between, do I leave where my children are to go get help? Or why isn't there help so I can still, you know, have contact with my children?
Mm-hmm.
So we have shifted to focusing on helping to build up more faith-based shelters across the United States and taken on a six-year initiative, so between, we started in 19, to establish new programs across the United States in areas of great need. So we are hoping that the Lord will bring those people that he's calling, that he's stirring, that he's having, you know, have those faithful encounters on the streets where they are, and stirring in their hearts to want to do this kind of work. And then we want to come alongside them and give them the training and the technical support and the mentoring and stay with them through the first 3 years of launching a shelter in their community so that we can really meet the need.
Well, my guest today is Jean Allard. She is the founder and executive director of the Samaritan Women in Maryland, and she is involved in a ministry to women and girls who have been sex trafficked. And as she's described, it is a huge problem. Her ministry, of course, is Christian-oriented. Most of them, she said, I think 65 to 70% are. There's a huge need. And so, Jean, let's say, for example, if we perhaps, you haven't said this specifically, but local churches, it would seem like they would be a logical choice or a logical place for such a shelter to grow out of or to come out of somebody in a local church. What do you recommend? How does somebody start a shelter? What should a church, I think I've heard you say something like congregational awareness has to start first, even before you can begin. But can you tell us sort of the genesis of how such a shelter might start in a community that doesn't have one?
The ideal would be that a congregation first takes on the commitment to become educated. And that can be to whatever, you know, extent and resources are available. But this is not a exercise in whimsy. You know, this is a long-term commitment with some very, very broken people. And so it is incumbent on us to go into this with wisdom. And so I would say starting with education, there are some good documentaries. There are certainly task forces and people who do great education program. We do education that's now all virtual. People can tap into that. So first you start by building a base of people within the congregation who are willing to commit time to learning about not only the victim population, but what does trafficking look like in your area? So I'll give you some examples. There, depending upon where you are geographically and sociographically, trafficking, sex trafficking can look very different. If you're in a college town, it might look like what's called sugaring, where wealthy individuals are exploiting college students and the ploy is paying for books and tuition and things like that. And so it's really an economic manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a more urban area that has prostitution, strip clubs and that kind, it might be more nightclub type activity or street level exploitation online. we see in some areas of the country where the trafficking of children by their parents is keenly tied to the drug trade, and, you know, mothers selling their children to strangers to get drugs. And so we're already walking into darkness, right? So we can't go in unaware.
Yeah.
And so it has to be a group of people who are saying, we are preparing ourselves spiritually to walk into a very dark topic, but we want to become knowledgeable, we want to bring light into that topic, and we want to understand not only what does it look like in our area, but what is the experiences of people who have been victimized, and then what are the resources in your community? You know, oddly enough, being in Baltimore, like I said, we might kid that it's kind of a rough urban area, but we have tremendous resources in Baltimore. I mean, you can't throw a stone and not hit a hospital. And we have drug rehabs, and we have lots of universities, and we have lots of resources in this area that actually make it quite advantageous. Conversely, we worked with a shelter in Nebraska, you know, that really had a hard time connecting with community resources because it was so remote. So you got to know what's available in your area and who can you partner with. Going into this work and doing it well, you have to be somebody who's willing to create partnerships, true partnerships, because you're going to need a lot of resources. And I don't mean financially. I mean, you know, we need dentists and we need pregnancy centers and we need other churches, and we're going to need financial support, and we're going to need a detox, and we're going to need, you know, the list goes on. We identified over 180 services that we have found necessary for this population. So as that congregation says, we've now formed this team that wants to get involved in this work, we would be happy to talk with them about what the shelter planting process looks like. And you start by getting a commitment from the community, whether that's within your congregation, that yes, we're going to take this on and we're in this for the long haul, and building those alliances, and then starting a good foundation for ministry. And this is one of the things I want to be emphatic about. Those are your listeners who are business people will understand that you can't just have a good idea. You also have to run a good business.
Mm-hmm.
And too many of the shelters that had started when ours started back in 07, have not prevailed because they didn't build a strong foundation. You know, the Bible tells us we're supposed to build on the rock, right?
Yeah.
And so that's part of having strong leadership, leadership that is spiritually mature, leadership that is going to attend to the business side of making sure that the staff is healthy, that the finances are healthy, that the legal issues are in place. And that foundation has to be established so that we believe, and we're pretty emphatic about this because we believe that we want the world to see our good works and give glory to our Father in heaven because the work is so good. It's so exemplary. And just being a bleeding heart doesn't make for necessarily good work. So we say we've got to lay a good foundation and show that in all ways that we do ministry, we are above reproach. And in the ways that we love, we are godly. We are heavenly. I have 1,000 stories, as you might imagine, but it is not uncommon for one of our women to, you know, come charging into my office and say something like, "Miss Jean, do you know that there are prostitutes in the Bible?" Like, yes, there are. And did you know how much Jesus loves them? So let's go look.
Mm-hmm.
And so even something like that is like an incredibly wide open invitation. And we just have to be available when that invitation has been presented to her and maximize on that opportunity. We try to choose materials that come from a faith position, whether that's a Financial Peace University or, you know, other topics, but they also have to get their GED, and they also have to get a job, and they also have to do, you know, things of the world as well. But it's really important to us that we, and to our care for them, that they see themselves as a spiritual being.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Jean Ellert, founder and executive director of Samaritan Women in Baltimore, Maryland. For more information, go to thesamaritanwomen.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at this same time for another edition of His People.